You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, we will continue today with the fourth turning by William Strauss and Neil Howe. We will continue talking about this landmark publication, and it's a landmark for one of two reasons, ladies and gentlemen. Either they have hit upon a pattern in history that is, without any doubt, self-explanatory when you read this book, and you will identify yourself amongst the generations that are discussed. Or this is one of the greatest pieces of propaganda to allow people to adapt to the coming socialist changes that will bring about a one-world totalitarian socialist government that's probably ever been written. If you couple this book with the works of Alvin Toffler, you will pretty much have a blueprint for the future. And ladies and gentlemen, unless you're a Marxist, socialist, atheist, you will not like what the future has in store for us. According to William Strauss, Neil Howe, and Alvin Toffler — we are not discussing Alvin Toffler's works today. We have done that on many other occasions in the past on the Hour of the Time. Don't go away. I'll be right back after this short pause. In the climactic years between Pearl Harbor and Victory Over Japan Day, known as VJ Day, Arguments were forgotten, ideals energized, and creaky institutions resuscitated for urgent new purposes. At least they appeared to be urgent at the time. At home or in the military, teamwork and discipline were unusually strong. Anybody who doubted or complained or bent the rules drew the wrath of fellow soldiers, co-workers, or neighbors. People, in fact, looked upon their elected representatives as moral exemplars. In 1943, the author of The Hero in History described the current age as brimming with leaders who qualified for the title Great Man in History. People were also full of hope, even in the face of terrible adversity. And during the summer of 1940, with France crushed and England hanging by a thread, writes David Gerlertner, a Roper poll found that a handsome plurality, 43% to 36, yeah, that's right, 43% to 36, was optimistic about the, quote, future of civilization, end quote. And energized by visionary leadership and hopeful followership, America attained an absolutely stunning triumph. With the people thus united, that era established a powerful new civic order, replete with new public institutions, economic arrangements, political alliances, and global treaties, many of which have lasted to this day. That era, ladies and gentlemen, also produced a grim acceptance of destruction as a necessary concomitant to human progress. Quite unlike today, that was a time when wars were fought to the finish, when a president could command a prized young generation to march off with the warning that one in three would not come home, when America's wisest and smartest scientists built weapons of mass destruction, when imagined domestic enemies were rounded up in snowy camps, when enemy armies were destroyed, their leaders hanged. Indeed, while this beloved spirit of America resonates with warm reminiscences from a distance of a half century, it was also, ladies and gentlemen, a time of extremely blunt, cruel, even lethal forms of social change. Today's elder veterans recall that era fondly, but very selectively. They would like to restore its unity and selflessness, but without the carnage. Yet how? The only way they can see is a way back, what Bob Dole calls a bridge to a better past. An America stripped of the family damage, cultural decay, and loss of civic purpose that has settled in over the intervening five decades. And such a task feels hopeless, ladies and gentlemen, because it is hopeless, cannot be done, will not be done. Like nature, history is full of processes that cannot happen in reverse. Just as the laws of entropy do not allow a bird to fly backwards or droplets to regroup at the top of a waterfall, history itself, just like nature, has no rewind button. Like the seasons of nature, it moves only forward. The only thing that I can guarantee you on this broadcast, ladies and gentlemen, is change. Change. Nothing in the future will ever, ever be exactly as it was ever in the past. Events will repeat. Movements will repeat. Hairstyles will repeat. Fashions will repeat. But even as they repeat, almost everything else will be changed. You see, there are repeating cycles in history that we can project into the future. However, they never coincide with repeating cycles of everything else that happened in the past, and even if they did, would not coincide at exactly the same time with the same cyclic repeat of all other events from the same time in history. It only moves forward. Change
will occur, whether we wish it to occur or not. The only thing that we can do about the change is to try to exert our influence to make sure that the change is for the better, ladies and gentlemen, and not for the worse. Cycular entropy cannot be reversed. An unraveling cannot lead back to an awakening or forward to a high without a crisis in between. The spirit of America, ladies and gentlemen, according to William Strauss and Neil Howe, comes once in a cyclone, only through what the ancients called ekpyrosis, nature's fiery moment of death and discontinuity, the symbol of which is the phoenix. History's periodic eras of crises combust the old social order and give birth to a new. It is the number 13. A fourth turning is a solstice era of maximum darkness, in which the supply of social order is still falling. But the demand for order is now rising. It is the cyclum's hibernal. It's time of trial. In winter, writes William Cullen Bryant, the melancholy days are come, the saddest of the year, of wailing winds and naked woods and meadows brown and sere. You see, nature exacts its fatal payment and pitilessly sorts out the survivors and the doomed. Pleasures recede, tempests hurt, pretense is exposed, and toughness is rewarded, all in a season. Says Victor Hugo that changes into stone the water of heaven and the heart of man. Changes into stone the water of heaven and the heart of man. These are times of fire and ice, of polar darkness, and brilliantly pale horizons. What it doesn't kill, it reminds of death. What it doesn't wound, it reminds of pain. In Swinburne's Season of Snows, it is the light that loses, the night that wins. And you'll remember Swinburne. We've covered his works on many, many a golden hour of the time. Like natural winter, which reaches its solstice early, the fourth turning passes the nadir of public order right at its beginning. Just as the coldest days of winter are days of lengthening sun, the harsh and less hopeful years of a crisis are years of renascent public authority. This, ladies and gentlemen, involves a fundamental shift in social momentum. In the unraveling, the removal of each civic layer brought demands for the removal of more layers. In the crises era, each new exercise of civic authority creates a perceived need for the adding of layers. As the community instinct regenerates, people resolve to do more than just relieve the symptoms of pending traumas. Intent on addressing root causes, they rediscover the value of unity, teamwork, and social discipline. Far more than before, people comply with authority, accept the need for public sacrifice, and shed anything extraneous to the survival needs of their community. This is a critical threshold. People either coalesce as a nation and culture, or rip hopelessly and permanently apart, never, never to be reunited. Well, what about the most recent 20 years? The most prevalent late 70s forecasts of late 90s America assumed, folks, that the trends of the 60s would continue along a straight line. This led to predictions of an acceleration of government planning, ongoing protests against social conformity, more God is dead secularism, delegitimized family life, less emphasis on money and weapons in a post-materialist age, and spectacular economic growth, which would either allow unprecedented leisure or plunge the planet into a huge ecological catastrophe. And we all know that none of that Absolutely none of it came to pass, of course. But in their triumphal enthusiasm, virtually all the late 70s forecasters made a more fundamental error. Whether their visions were utopian or apocalyptic, veering toward Epcot Center or Soylent Green, they all assumed that America was heading somewhere in a hurry. No one imagined what actually happened, that through the 80s and 90s, while different societal pieces have drifted in different directions, America, as a whole, has gone absolutely nowhere, nowhere in particular. As before, these forecasters missed the target because they failed to look at life cycle trajectories, according to Strauss and Howe. They failed to realize that all the generations were poised to enter new phases of life, and that, as they did, people up and down the life cycle would think and behave differently. This is what they say happened. In elderhood, the confident GIs were due to be replaced by the more hesitant silent, who would prefer a more complex, diverse, and individuated social order. In midlife, the conciliatory silent were ready to give way to the more judgmental boomers, who would enforce a confrontational ethic of moral conviction. In young adulthood, the passionate boomers were set to vacate for the more pragmatic 13ers, whose survivalism would be born of necessity. In childhood, the neglected 13ers were about to be replaced by the more treasured millennial generation, born between 1982 and the year 2002, or about the year 2002, amid a resurgent commitment to protect and provide for small children. As a result of all these life cycle shifts, the national mood would change into something new. Howe and Strauss believed that back in the 70s, the experts could have envisioned what this mood would be. But how? Well, by looking at an earlier awakening era with a similar generational constellation and inquiring into what happened next. And isn't that the way that you study cycles of nature and of history? According to them, the millennial generation, known as the hero, born 1982 and ending somewhere around the year 2002 or thereabouts, first arrived when babies on board signs appeared. Remember that? Those ridiculous little, look like road signs, yellow, that people put in their windows. Baby on board, baby on board, look at me, look at me. As abortive and divorce rates ebbed, the popular culture began stigmatizing hands-off parental styles and recasting babies as special. Child abuse and child safety became hot topics, while books teaching virtues and values became bestsellers. Never mind that very few people paid any attention to those virtues or values. Today, politicians divine adult issues from tax cuts to deficits in terms of their effects on children. That's the big propaganda ploy. You want to legitimize something? Link it to children. You want to demonize somebody or something? Link it to children. Hollywood is replacing cinematic child devils with child angels, have you noticed? And cable TV and the internet are cordoning off child-friendly havens, while educators speak of standards and cooperative learning. School uniforms are surging in popularity, with adults viewing children more positively. United States test scores are faring better in international comparisons, but not by much. Some of the people that you can say were born in the millennial generation are Jessica McClure, the Olsen twins, Baby Richard, Eliza Lopez, Dooney Waters, Jessica Dubroff, and Anna Paquin, and Prince William. And so what about today, ladies and gentlemen? What does all this mean for today? Well, forecasters, according to Strauss and Howe, are still making exactly the same mistakes. Best-selling books today envision a post-millennial America of unrelenting individualism, social fragmentation, and weakening government.
a nation becoming ever more diverse and decentralized, its citizens inhabiting a high-tech world of tightening global ties and loosening personal ones, its websites multiplying and its culture splintering. We hear an awful lot of talk about how elder life will improve and child's life deteriorate, how the rich will get richer and the poor will get poorer, and how today's kids will come of age with a huge youth crime wave. Well, folks, William Strauss and Neil Howe, in their book, The Fourth Turning, say, don't bet on it. They say the rhythms of history suggest that none of those trends will last more than a few years into the new century. What will come afterward, they say, can be glimpsed by studying earlier unraveling eras with similar generational constellations and inquiring into what happened next. And to inquire correctly, they say, we must link each of today's generations with a recurring sequence of four generational archetypes that have appeared throughout all the cycula of our history. These four archetypes are best identified by the turning of their births. They say that a prophet generation is born during a high. A nomad generation is born during an awakening. A hero generation is born during an unraveling. And an artist generation is born during a crisis. And don't give these words or these names the meaning that you have traditionally applied, because it ain't so, folks. You see, they believe that each archetype is an expression of one of the enduring temperaments and life cycle myths of mankind. When history overlays these archetypes atop of the four turnings, the result is four very generational constellations. And as I told you before, you will recognize yourself in one of these four, and it will be clear to you. This, folks, explains why a new turning occurs every 20 years or so, and why history rolls to so many related pendular rhythms, what I have always termed in my life as cycles. One turning will underprotect children, for example, while another will overprotect them. The same is true with attitudes toward politics, affluence, war, religion, family, hairstyles, gender roles, clothing, fashions, pluralism, and a host of other trends. Dating back to the first stirrings of the Renaissance, Anglo-American history has traversed six secular cycles, each of which, ladies and gentlemen, displayed a similar rhythm. Every cycle had four turnings, and except for the anomalous U.S. Civil War, every cycle produced four generational archetypes. We are presently in the third turning of the millennial cyclum, the seventh cycle of the modern era, according to William Strauss and Neil Howe. By looking at history through this secular prism, they say that you can see why the American mood has evolved as it has during your own lifetime. Reflect back as far as you can, and see if you can recall how the persona of people in any phase of life has changed completely every two decades or so. Every time, these changes have followed the archetypical pattern. And I'm going to tell you what those are right now, so pay close attention and see where you fit in here. The life cycle of the prophet archetype. We remember prophets best for their coming-of-age passion, the excited pitch of Jonathan Edwards, William Lloyd Garrison, William Jennings Bryan, and for their principles, elder stewardship. For example, the sober pitch of Samuel Langdon at Bunker Hill, President Lincoln at Gettysburg, or Franklin Delano Roosevelt with his, quote, fireside chats, end quote. Increasingly indulged as children, they became increasingly protective as parents. Their principal endowments are in the domain of vision, values, and religion.
Their best-known leaders include John Winthrop and William Berkeley, Samuel Adams and Benjamin Franklin, James Polk and Abraham Lincoln, and Herbert Hoover and Franklin Roosevelt. These have been principal moralists, according to Strauss and Howe. Personally, I find fault with some of this. I don't believe that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a principled moralist at all. I believe that he was an abject Marxist socialist who began this country's plunge into what's definitely going to happen in the future, according to my research. They believe, Strauss and Howe, that these people are summoners of human sacrifice, that to be sure, wagers of righteous wars. Well, they make it seem that way, but it does not stand the scrutiny of any legitimate research. It is not righteous at all. In fact, it is extremely destructive. Early in life, none saw combat in uniform. None of these people that I just told you about saw combat in uniform. Late in life, most came to be revered more for their inspiring words than for any grand deeds. And that is the absolute truth concerning all of them. Here's a life cycle outline, according to Strauss and Howe, of the prophets, the prophet generation, or as they call it, the prophet archetype. As prophets replace artists in childhood during a high, they are nurtured with increasing indulgence by optimistic adults in a secure environment. As self-absorbed prophets replace artists in young adulthood during an awakening, they challenge the moral failure of elder-built institutions, sparking a society-wide spiritual awakening. As judgmental prophets replace artists in midlife, during an unraveling, they preach a downbeat, values-fixated ethic of moral conviction. As visionary prophets replace artists in elderhood during a crisis, they push to resolve ever-deepening moral choices, setting the stage for the secular goals of the young. Now here is the life cycle of the nomad archetype. According to Strauss and Howe, we remember nomads best for their rising adult years of hell-raising, the Paxton Boys, Missouri Raiders, Rum Runners, and for their middle life years of hands-on, get-it-done leadership, such as Francis Marion, Stonewall Jackson, and General George Patton. Underprotected as children, they become overprotective parents. Their principal endowments are in the domain of liberty, survival, and honor. Their best-known leaders include Nathaniel Bacon and William Stoughton, George Washington and John Adams, Ulysses Grant and Grover Cleveland, Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower. These have been cunning, hard-to-fool realists, taciturn warriors who prefer to meet problems and adversaries one-on-one. They include the only two presidents who had earlier hanged a man, Washington and Cleveland, one governor who hanged witches, Stoughton, and several leaders who had earlier led troops into battle, Bacon, Washington, Grant, Truman, and Eisenhower. This is the life cycle outline of the nomads, according to Strauss and Howe. As nomads replace prophets in childhood during an awakening, they are left underprotected as a time of social convulsion and adult self-discovery. As alienated nomads replace prophets in young adulthood during an unraveling, they become brazen free agents, lending their pragmatism and independence to an era of growing social turmoil. As pragmatic nomads replace prophets in midlife during a crisis, they apply toughness and resolution to defend society while safeguarding the interests of the young. And as exhausted nomads replace prophets in elderhood during a high, they slow the pace of social change, shunning the old crusades in favor of simplicity and survivalism. This is the life cycle of the hero archetype.
According to Strauss and Howe, we remember heroes best for their collective coming-of-age triumphs. Glorious Revolution, Yorktown, D-Day, and for their hubristic elder achievements, the Peace of Utrecht and slave codes, the Louisiana Purchase and steamboats, the Apollo moon launches and interstate highways. Increasingly protected as children, they become increasingly indulgent as parents. Their principal endowment activities are in the domain of community affluence and technology. Their best-known leaders include Gurdon Saltonstall and King Carter. Economic prosperity and public optimism in midlife, and all have maintained a reputation for civic energy and competence even deep into old age. This is a life cycle outline for heroes, according to Strauss and Howe. As heroes replace nomads in childhood during an unraveling, they are nurtured with increasing protection by pessimistic adults in an insecure environment. As teamworking heroes replace nomads in young adulthood during a crisis, they challenge the political failure of elder-led crusades fueling a society-wide secular crisis. As powerful heroes replace nomads in midlife during a high, they establish an upbeat, constructive ethic of social discipline. As expansive heroes replace nomads in elderhood during an awakening, they orchestrate ever-granded secular constructions, setting the stage for the spiritual goals of the young. And here is the last but not least, the life cycle of the artist architect, according to Strauss and Howe. They say that we remember artists best for their quiet years of rising adulthood, the log cabin settlers of 1800. The plains farmers of 1880, the new suburbanites of 1960, and during their midlife years of flexible consensus-building leadership, the compromises of the Whig era, the good government reforms of the progressive era, the budget and peace processes of the current era. Overprotected as children, they become underprotective parents. Their principal endowment activities are in the domain of pluralism, expertise and due process. Their best-known leaders include William Shirley and Cadwallader Colden, John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson, Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, Walter Mondale and Colin Powell. These have been sensitive and complex social technicians, advocates of fair play and the politics of inclusion. With the single exception of Andrew Jackson, they rank as the most expert and credentialed of American political leaders. And folks, in my research, I wouldn't leave Andrew Jackson out of there. Andrew Jackson did one great thing for this country, and I'll leave that for you to look it up. I've told you what it is before, and so you should know. If you don't, look it up. A life cycle outline for artists is, according to Strauss and Howe, as artists replace heroes in childhood during a crisis, they are overprotected at a time of political convulsion and adult self-sacrifice. As conformists, artists replace heroes in young adulthood during a high. They become sensitive helpmates, lending their expertise and cooperation to an era of growing social calm. As indecisive artists replace heroes in midlife during an awakening, they apply expertise and process to improve society while calming the passions of the young. And as emphatic artists replace heroes in elderhood during an unraveling, they quicken the pace of social change, shunning the old order in favor of complexity and sensitivity.
Baby, I've been wasted. I've been waiting night and day. I didn't see the time. I waited half my life away. invitation. I know you sent me some, but I was waiting for the miracle to come.
A couple of friends called me over the weekend, ladies and gentlemen, wanted to know why I was playing so much of Leonard Cohen's work. Well, it's very simple, ladies and gentlemen. It's because Leonard Cohen is a Marxist socialist. He writes and sings songs about what's coming, the plans of Marxist socialism for the world. And I do this to let you know that this isn't hidden. Well, it began as a conspiracy, and some may claim that it is still a conspiracy. It is all out in the open. It is in the writings of socialists everywhere. It is in best-selling books that you read on a daily basis. It's on the television and on the radio. It is in the laws that are passed, the speeches that are made. And the message is clear. There is no room in the future millennium for Christians or for anyone of any other religion than secular humanism. There is no room for people who believe in ideals and principles such as those which founded this country. There is no room for people who believe they should be rewarded for their work and be able to build for themselves and for their future generations. There's going to be a redistribution of wealth, your wealth. And if you listen to the music that your children listen to, and to artists such as Leonard Cohen, or for that matter, John Lennon, listen to his song, Imagine. Listen to the words with your mind, your intellect, and not your heart. And then wake up, because you've been had. Consider, ladies and gentlemen, the generational transitions of the past decade, if you will, which are once again proving the linear forecasters are wrong. As the silent have begun reaching retirement age, national leaders have shown less interest in making public institutions do big things and more interest in making them flexible, fair, expert, nuanced, and participatory. Why? The elder artist is replacing the elder hero. As boomers have begun turning 50, the public discourse has become less refined and conciliatory, and more impassioned and moralistic. Why? The midlife prophet is replacing the midlife artist. As 13ers have filled the 20-something bracket, the pop culture has become less about soul, free love, and feeling at one with the world, and a lot more about cash, money, material possessions, status, sexual disease, and going it alone in an unforgiving world. Why? Because the young adult nomad is replacing the young adult prophet. As millennials have surged into America's elementary and junior high schools, family behavior has reverted toward greater protection. Why? We are now raising the child hero, no longer the child nomad. And when you compile these four archetypal shifts through the entire life cycle, you see how America's circa 1970s constellation has transformed into something new. From top to bottom, the whole spectrum in the 90s. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why the nation has shifted from a mood of awakening to one of unraveling. When you apply this secular logic forward into the double-aught decade and beyond, you can begin to understand why a fourth turning is coming and how America's mood will change when this crisis hits. And ladies and gentlemen, whether this crisis occurs because of what they say in this book, there will be a crisis, and everybody listening to this broadcast knows it. Everybody knows it. You can feel it in your gut. Everything is wrong. Turns upside down, backward and forward. What used to be bad is now good, and what used to be good is now bad. People have lost their place in the scheme of things, and freedom, unless a lot of people are prepared to give their lives in defense of it, is foredoomed. It'll be legislated out of existence, treated off the face of this earth. And if the word even survives, it won't be in the common man's dictionary because they won't want him to know anything about it. The Fourth Turning, ladies and gentlemen, by William Strauss and Neil Howe, is a book that turns history into prophecy. After years of examining the cycles of American history, the authors have reached this startling conclusion. Starting about 10 years from now, America will enter an era of crises, an era of political and social upheaval that will extend until the late 2020s. We call this era a fourth turning, and we believe it will be a major threshold in the nation's history, climaxing with events on par with the Revolution, the Civil War, or World War II. And William Strauss and Neil Howe may be correct. They may have hit upon something, but their assessment of the historical generational trends and the four turnings, which they write about in this book, may be right on target, or this book just may have been written to legitimize and indoctrinate this change in the minds of the sheeple of America. For believe me, ladies and gentlemen, the battle for the future is in America, no place else in the world. This is where the battlefield is, and this is where the outcome will be decided. They believe that they've discovered this prophecy while looking for something else. That's what they say, the fourth turning, they say, is the product of a decade-long collaboration extending back to when they started writing their first book called Generations. You see, they were really studying generations. They were deeply interested in generational issues, and at the time they presumed that the relationship between their generation and others, unlike anything that had ever occurred before. But the more deeply they reviewed American history, the more they realized that only the details were new, the underlying rhythms were not. When they wrote Generations primarily as a history book with chapter-length biographies of the 18 generations from the first Puritans to today's young children, they also observed how generations tend to come in cycles of four types. And in a closing chapter, they applied those cycles to offer predictions about America's near-term future. You see, they suspected that amid all the buzz about information ages and new world orders, the seasonal patterns observed by the ancients might be hardwired into the inner nature of modern society. And they predicted in 1990, for example, that America would split into competing culture wars camps, that politics would become moralistic and mean, that family values would become a new vogue, and that the emergence of a hardened and alienated youth generation would provoke caustic media reaction. When the 1990s did, in fact, unfold, as the cycles would have suggested, they felt a pressing need to alert people about where the nation appeared to be heading. And so they wrote the fourth turning. It is by far, ladies and gentlemen, the most personal of the three books that they have written together. And I can tell you right now, it's one of the most personal books that you will ever read amongst all of the books that you have ever read. The authors are concerned about what the coming crises will mean for their own families. And between them, they have six children ranging in age from 2 to 19 and five living parents-in-laws from 69 to 87. The life ahead that they see for their daughters and sons, the future memory of their parents, the old age they and their wives, Janie and Simona, will experience, all this, they say, was on their minds and in their hearts when they wrote the fourth turning. Will the fourth turning prophecy be proven right? Will we enter a new era that transforms the lives of all those who live through it? Will America break apart? Will there be heroism of myth-making proportions? And they ask this final question, which for those of you who have been listening to this broadcast for years will recognize immediately as a flag flying in the breeze for the recognition of the brotherhood. They ask this question, quote, will our children achieve a new golden age, end quote. Well, ladies and gentlemen, only time can tell for sure. I know that there is great change coming. There will be a terrible confrontational crisis in this country. But no matter who you are, no matter what your age or sex or income or family status, the message of this book should be read, and you should make some attempt to understand it and see where you fit into all of this and try to ascertain whether this is a legitimate work or a work of propaganda. And it doesn't matter which one it turns out to be, ladies and gentlemen, because if it turns out to be either one or the other, it signals tremendous hardship for all of us in the near future. And I disagree with them. I do not think that the beginning of this crisis is 10 or 20 years in the future. I believe it has already begun. And it is in the talking stage now and in the testing stage, pushing to see how far one or the other can go before it erupts in flames. America is already splintered into so many different camps and political viewpoints and ideologies and cultures and races and all of these different factions are tearing at each other's throats. For the most part, it has been created and manipulated. It is intentional, ladies and gentlemen, for a people that has been divided or a people that are easily conquered. But it will not come easy, I can assure you of that. There are too many people like me who believe in freedom for all people, of all religions, all points of ancestral origin. You see, I don't care who you are. I don't care what church you go to. I know what church I wish you would belong to, but I would never, ever try to talk you into giving up what you believe is right and doing what I believe is right. For I truly, ladies and gentlemen, believe in freedom. I believe in constitutional republican government. I believe in creator-endowed individual rights that can never be taken away. I believe in those things. Not only do I believe in them, ladies and gentlemen, but I believe also that if I'm not willing to stand up and claim what I believe in, and fight for those things, and yes, even die for them, that I don't deserve them. And I don't believe anybody throughout the history of the world who wasn't willing and ready to die for certain principles and ideals soon lost them The history is there for anyone who wants to look. And I go even farther than that. I believe those people are already dead and are probably of no use or consequence whatsoever to anyone. It must have value. There must be something in this world that is worth everything. If there isn't, someone will come along and take it away from you because you will not fight for it. And believe me, folks, a bully always knows a false fight. A bully knows if you're willing to go the distance or if you're just going to throw a couple of punches and fade into the playground. My father was an Air Force pilot, an officer. And about every year to 2 years or 3 years, depending on where we were and what the reason was that we were there. For instance, if my father was attending some kind of an Air Force school, we might only be there 6 months to a year and then move. And then depending upon what his new mission was, we might be there for a year or 2 years or 3 years. And so I changed schools frequently throughout my young life. And one of the first things that I learned to do after being severely beaten as a young boy by school bullies and not fighting back because my mother didn't want me to fight, as soon as I would arrive at a new school, I would seek out the bully, the class bully, the one that everyone was afraid of. I would walk right up to him and I would punch him in the mouth just as hard as I could, and I never had any trouble from anybody after that, and I never had to fight anybody after that at that school. But then when I moved, I had to do it all over again. Many of us have learned that lesson in life. Some of us have never learned it. Some of you listening have been the victims of bullies all your lives and maybe always will until you learn that lesson. And that lesson, ladies and gentlemen, does not just apply to individuals on school grounds. It applies to the world in general, to nations, to organizations, to peoples, to races, to religions. We are now confronted with a bully that wants to enslave the entire human race. And the only way that they're going to do that, ladies and gentlemen, is over my dead body. Good night, and God bless each and every single one of you. The book is The Fourth Turning by William Strauss and Neil Howe. Get it. Read it.
At the break of day, start again. I heard them say, don't dwell on what has passed away or what is yet to be. Yeah, the war, they will be fought again. The holy dove, she will be cut again. Body and soul in part again. The dove is never free. We asked for signs, the signs were sent. The birth betrayed, the marriage spent. Thank you. Dracula in high places say their prayers aloud. But they've summoned a big thundercloud. They're gonna hear from me. Ring the bell, let's stay on.
This is the Voice of Freedom. You're listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to help yourselves and help the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network continue to expand its programming, then call Southwest International Trading right now at 1-800-295-2432. That's 1-800-295-2432. And ask how you can obtain the Economic Survival Pack number 1.
This is my daddy's station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, eager.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a non-profit community service.
We now present for your listening enjoyment all oldies, most of the time, only the very best of the music from all of the generations, but not up to, or including the present. That will have its own day as an oldie. To all of the listeners and affiliate stations across the nation and around the world of the Hour of the Time and the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network, the Hour of the Time will be rerun at 8 Pacific, 11 Eastern, Monday through Friday nights, right here on the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network.